Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prusgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are at coming to you through the great services of KHOI Community Radio. So, Donna, it snowed.
Finally.
Well, see, you get what you ask for. Now it sure feels like winter, and even good old dry central Iowa finally has a bit of snow to brag about. Well, I don't know, that 6-7 inches at my place.
Yeah, more than a bit, actually.
It's more than a bit, and we are kind of battening down for some more cold. I want to remind people that have chickens and other livestocky sort of things, especially if you're kind of new to this, that this is the hungry season, folks, and chickens are pretty tasty to a lot of our wild neighbors. I lost a chicken to a hungry raccoon. He just kind of ate his way through a rotten piece of siding and helped himself. Only one, lost one.
Well, you're lucky.
Yes, so quick. Fix that hole. Things are fine now.
And the foxes are out and about.
Everybody's
yeah.
out. And be careful. So, all right. Everybody's got to one-up everybody about, oh, but the snow is deeper. Oh, and the chickens are in more peril. So I tell my brother, who lives in Montana, chickens, I lost a chicken to a raccoon. He says, that's nothing out in Montana. He just lost two chickens to a mountain lion.
Woo! Exciting.
He could tell by paw prints. They were out in only two. So remember, it's the hungry season. It is cold out there, folks. Be careful and keep everybody warm and snugged in.
And well fed,
yes. Oh, well, since the weather outside is frightful, we decided to do a little armchair traveling with a good book. Today, we are exploring the book, Tasting Georgia, A Food and Wine Journey in the Caucasus by Carla Capalbo. Did I say that right?
Yeah,
Capalbo?
Sounds good.
Capalbo? So,
it's from the Ames Library, so when we're done with the show, we'll take the book back and somebody else can check it out.
Oh, it's one of those that just has the best pictures. And what's nice, we give our taste buds a vacation too, because the country of Georgia has some really interesting things to explore. So to join us in our journey,
yes, we have our very own local Georgian,
Gio Chlatsi, and we are lucky, absolutely lucky, to have been at his table a few times over the past few years, and I've learned a lot about interesting food things.
Yes, Gio came to ISU to study agricultural engineering and got his PhD here, and he stayed. We're lucky. So welcome, Gio.
Hi, Lona and Lona. So thank you very much for hosting me on your show.
Well, now Gio has made a lot of Georgian food for us, so we're a little slightly experienced anyway. And
well, we've tasted a lot of food. This is good. So we know, but we have some questions. First off, we are talking about the country of Georgia. So,
not the state of Georgia.
So, Gio, can you kind of give us a rough idea? Where is Georgia?
Okay, so that's kind of question that I hear quite often. So the Georgia, where is it? And so it's between Black Sea and Caspian Sea, if you know that part, or if you know Caucasian Mountains, it's south part of Caucasian Mountains. But sometimes I just use the country that are neighboring Georgia, which are four countries. So on the north side, we have Russian. On the south side, we have Turkey and Armenia. And on the east side, we have Azerbaijan.
So the history books say that Georgia was in the middle of many, many trading routes, and the foods are very influenced by a lot of the neighboring countries as well.
Yes. So
I also want to say on the cover of the book, there's a quote from Rene Redzepi, who is the world-renowned chef of Noma in, is it Denmark or I don't know, somewhere up there.
One of them Scandinavian.
And he says that Georgian food is perhaps the last undiscovered great food cultures of Europe in Georgia. And I would tend to agree with him. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I'm guessing, and maybe it's a fantasy, but it looks like a lot of these still small scale, non-industrial agricultural things are still intact. Gil, what do you think compared to us?
I can tell you that most of the agriculture are done in small scale, and so we have a lot of like local farmers normally like producing small batches, and so it's still there, it's still running, and hopefully it will continue like that for a longer time, because all these produce that are made in Georgia are unique and they have varieties that are only like produced in Georgia, and so if you, we hope, or at least I hope, that it's not going to be lost over the time.
Well, I have noticed, because you've had a few other Georgians arrive and you've offered them hospitalities, and they always arrive with their suitcases full of food.
Yes, they are smuggling some food. Yes. And wine. So wine is the whole story. So I suppose it's separate story about Georgian wine. But.
Oh, yes. That is a wonderful story. So let's talk about wine. Wine is, again, you mentioned that wine making in Georgia is done in by small farmers and a lot of small scale winemakers. So there's a lot of different tastes.
And the winemaking tradition of Georgia is 6,000 to 8,000 years old. It's perhaps maybe the first winemaking culture. Gio, what do you think?
So right now, yes. The evidence says that the Georgia is the oldest country that was producing the wine, so 8,000 years. And the next one that was is 7,000 years old, which is coming from Persia. And then in Italy, you can find like the evidence of winemaking, which is 6,000 years. So it's like 2 millennia later. So based on the archaeological like evidence, definitely. But
well, they've had lots of practice.
Yes, we have been practicing wine making and wine drinking for a lot of years or a lot of centuries. And that's a very important part of our culture. And so we are really proud of it. Even if we're not the oldest one, we're making it for so long that it's become part of our nation and part of our identity.
Oh, good, good.
And you have really special techniques. So tell us about that. What are they called? Cuvari?
Yes. So the traditions of winemaking has been intact for millennia. So it can be like going back all the way to like 6,000, 8,000 years ago. And you can find the same sort of like methodology has been used before. And this is like a really relatively simple method. It is now considered to be the natural winemaking process. And we are using this big vessels, which is like, look like a brick amphora, but quite big size, so it can be...
Yeah, some of them up to 1,000 gallons or something?
Yes, some of them are up to 1,000 gallons. Typically, it's around 300 gallons. So it's big enough that a human can go inside and clean and do all the stuff.
And
before
it's made out of clay?
It's made up of clay, yes, and it is buried in the ground. So you are like putting the whole vessel down into the ground, and only the rim of the vessel, the quivery, can be seen from the top. And the technology itself is quite old and hasn't been changed. So what you're doing, you just like crush your grapes, all stems and skin, everything goes to the quivery. And you are fermenting it in the quivery for around 3 weeks. So the fermentation goes there in the big vessel under, which is buried in the ground.
So it's basically a wild yeast, because it goes in with the stems and the seeds and the skins and everything.
Yeah, so there's nothing added.
They don't add anything.
Nothing is added. It's just like wild yeast is fermenting, so it's coming from the stems, from the air, and it's going to ferment for 3 weeks, and after 3 weeks, you are just filling the whole vessel with all the grapes, with all the skins left inside. You are not removing them, and you are keeping it like this for about 6 months. and after 6 months you're opening and removing the liquid part, like the wine that was forming and is floating on top, because all the other parts are kind of dropping down and only wine is left on the top.
Oh, right. The quivery is it's shaped so that it's like a little cone kind of thing, so the wine rises up to the top and the sediment goes down to the bottom.
Yes. It has kind of egg shape in some way, mm-hmm. with a pointy part going down. So like in this pointy part, you are like collecting all the sediment and the wine is on top, floating on top. And
so
then
how do they remove the wine from the quivery and where do they put it next?
So normally they have like another quivery next to it and they're just siphoning from one to another. And that's kind of like, it's a little fork, but like it's forked. And the wine.
And then it has to ferment or it has to sit further?
Normally, we don't let the wine to get old. We just drink 1 year wine. So
1 year. So only 1 year for the winemaking process. That's compared to other wines, that's relatively fresh.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're talking grape wine here. Evidently, the climate is very good for growing grapes.
It is. I mean, the climate is quite diverse. So if the Georgia, if you look at it, so it's really like changing from one side to another. It's half of Iowa in terms of size, but it's so diverse. So we have like mountains, like Rocky Mountains. Yes, we have like the special part of Georgia which grows the grapes, which is Cassetti. It's similar to Napa Valley here. We have like the seaside part where we have like oranges and mandarins growing on. We have also our like tea plantation growing. So we have like quite a lot of diversity in terms of nature. So we have high altitude mountains and we have like seaside part and we have even like some desert part, which not as big or as vast as the desert in US or somewhere else, but there's still some little desert too. And so this kind of blessings for us, so we can grow diversity also produce, and one of them is a wine, and the wine has been growing in Georgia so long, so it's like one of the oldest varieties that you can trace to Georgia, and right now about like 1/6 of the varieties, like unique varieties of grapes are wine grapes, are originated from Georgia, so endemic varieties, we have around 500 of them. Actually more than 500, and so imagine like in Iowa, if we have like in each county have 5 unique varieties of wine grapes that is not found anywhere in the world. So that's kind of like the situation that we have in Georgia.
Well, I have to tell a nice story about Gia. I don't know, maybe 5 years, maybe more. Anyway, there was a year where Gia actually made wine with some local grapes.
From here.
Yeah. Where did you get the grapes? Do you remember? Was it from the ISU Hort Farm?
Yes, it was from ISU Hort Farm.
And I have to say the results were really, really stunning. I have never had a fresh homemade wine taste as good as Gio. Must just be a Georgian capacity because it was really good.
Whatever it was. Yes, it was
right,
good.
We had the children actually stomping on the grapes for us, and it was really, really fun. So we can do it even here in Iowa.
Yes.
It's quite easy. And actually, like, most of the Georgians are making their own wine. Having, like, house wine is very normal. Like, it's not every Georgian, at least every other Georgian, has their own homemade wine. And I grew up with that particular tradition, even though I was living in the city, in the capital, in a flat, not in the private property or house. We're making our own wine every year with my father, and so we're having the guests to offer this homemade wine. So
you made the wine in the apartment?
So we're making wine. We're stamping in the garage. We have a garage for cars, so we're taking out the garage, and during this like 1 or 2 month period, we're making the wine in the garage, and then we're transferring to the flat, so to our apartment.
And where did you store it?
We were storing in the glass jar. So we have the quivery at home, so we cannot like really make the quivery.
No.
Very good. I'm so glad that there is a place where there is a real tradition of do it yourself. I like that. And we got inspired by this Tasting Georgia book. It has all kinds of wonderful things to share, including pictures of the wine, the big
quivery,
the things that get buried.
Lots of pictures in this book.
And yes, they are big as a person. Oh, how nice. Let's talk about some other food traditions. There's one thing that I've noted, well, from things you've fed me, a lot of nuts are used. Nuts and
walnuts.
And
a lot of walnuts and some hazelnuts, right?
Talk about that.
Gil, what's that sauce that you make out of with the walnuts?
With the walnuts. Trutella? You mean like the
Oh, that's the candy, right?
That's the candy one? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking there's a sauce too with smashed walnuts and some herbs maybe or something.
Oh. We have like also olives. I suppose I have made so many things like for you. Even though like I'm not particularly good cook and
modesty here.
I mean in Georgia we have the tradition at least when I was growing up, the boys was not allowed to cook, so we're not allowed to do too much in the kitchen. So I did not do anything until I started living alone. So I started cooking when I moved to U.S. in 2006, and I started cooking since then. So, yeah, so walnuts is really like big deal. So most of Georgian food will have walnuts one or another way. And so it's so common, so it's kind of... I thought it was like very typical for any cuisine, but once I moved out of Georgia, I find out that no, it's Georgian food, not about walnut, actually.
Oh, very good.
Here's the tradition of tell us about the supra and the tamada.
Oh, yes. So the supra is a way like to celebrate any event. You will find an event every day to celebrate actually in Georgia. So you will have the supras where you invite your friends, where you open, you have all the Georgian food that you can
make.
It's
like a dinner party.
It's a big dinner feast. Yes, it's a big feast. And the important part of the feast is to have Georgian food, wine, and of course, the third element is the Georgian music. So you cannot just simply like have the supra without good Georgian music. So... And the Georgians were considered like Italians during Soviet time because every Georgian can sing, except of me. I cannot sing, but all the rest of Georgians can sing, which is not fair to me.
Oh, how nice. Well, a little earlier, I don't know, I didn't hear it over my earphones here, but earlier when we started talking about wine, there was a men's chorus singing polyphonic chanting. Can you tell us about that?
So the Georgian polyphony is really unique in its way, and so we are like having this polyphony as a part of our culture, and we are trying to, it's kind of secret for us, and we are keeping it alive, and we are like trying to make sure that the new generations will continue the traditions, and in Georgian supras you will find like a very open, people will tend to start singing Georgian polyphonic songs, and it's very old traditional songs, and they're so nice and harmonic, so it makes you like to relax and enjoy the atmosphere even more. And
so it's a cappella then?
It's a cappella, yes. It's mostly a cappella.
Okay, and then who's the tamada?
Okay, so the tamada is a toastmaster, so that's how it's translated in English. So the toastmaster is a person who is proposing the toast. So in Georgia, we don't just drink the wine like this. We don't sip the wine. So we have our own tradition of drinking the wine, which means if you want to drink the wine, you have to raise your glass with wine and say a toast. Without saying a toast, you cannot drink a wine or alcohol in general. It's quite rude. So the tamada is a person who is kind of leading this festivity, this supra. So he is proposing or she is proposing the toast, and everybody is listening, and then everybody says the same toast in their own interpretation. So the toast might be about the love, and the Tamada Gutamada will kind of will say and explain what the love is for him and or her, and maybe give some, say some lyrics, like read some poem. And then another person will be able to say the same, like a toast for love with his or her own words. And so everybody is like, hey, saying the same toast. After everybody is done, the toastmaster or Tamada is proposing another toast and so on. And the sutra is continuing like this. Everybody is like toasting some very traditional things like love, family, children, peace, and so on. They're like very traditional toasts. And then there are some non-traditional toasts too. And some are related to the event. If it's your birthday, it will be your like toast, and everybody will toast you. And it's common everywhere, I suppose. So,
and so is the Tamada a member of the family, or somebody gets invited specifically because they have a talent for this, or how does it work?
Okay, so it depends on the event. So when you have a big event, like a wedding, you would have a special person.
Oh, professional Tamada comes.
Professional Tamada will come, because it's really hard like to manage the big weddings, because
big crowd,
when you have
yeah.
hundreds of people sitting, and it's quite noisy, and you want to be like quite loud and sticking out and be representative. And so then you have somebody really like good Tamada. When it's at home, you can be the head of the family, or any like guest can be a Tamada. So Tamada can be any person who is a good orator and who is a good drinker too, because you have to drink too.
but it's a designated person at the meal.
Yes.
Right.
You are selecting it in the beginning of the meal.
Very good. Let's take a little break here and get back and talk about more about the Georgian table. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We are the Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. We are talking to our friend Gio Talatse today, and we're talking about the country of Georgia and how lucky we are that there is a place that has a wonderful and varied food tradition. I'm going to talk a little bit about the interesting sorts of breads that are available, because everybody does it differently. And there's all sorts of things, not just bread, but the things inside of the bread. So, Donna, take it away.
Well, apparently, the most popular thing to emerge from Georgia is the, what are they called? Hachapuri, right? Gio has made us mini hachapuri. And apparently, they come in all kinds of different styles, depending on where you're from. So, Gio, tell us about your hachapuri, which I particularly enjoy.
So there's many kinds of hachapuri, so, and it's become quite popular in the West, and it's quite, some people call it like Georgian pizza, but it's not a pizza.
There's no tomato in it, okay?
No tomato. It's mostly like cheese and bread, and the one that I like, it is called Ajaruli hachapuri, which means hachapuri from this region called Ajara, and this is, has a boat shape. It has like prolonged boat or eye shape. And
right, they're individual.
And they're individual, portions. Yes, portions, but quite big portions sometimes. And you have the cheese, which is melted on top, and also you have the runny egg that is like floating on top. And then you are like mixing it together before eating like egg and melted cheese, and you are breaking the side of this bread, this boat-shaped bread, and dipping into this like mixture and eating it piece by piece.
Right, like the individual portion has a kind of a well in the middle of it, even though it's kind of eye-shaped with points on the end, it has a well in the middle of it. In the well is where you put the cheese mixture. And it's usually kind of soft cheeses. I mean, obviously in Georgia, they use Georgian cheeses because they have a big culture. So what do you use as a substitute here, you know, for the cheeses?
So for cheeses, I use a substitute mozzarella and feta, a mixture of mozzarella and feta.
Mozzarella cheese. And feta mixed together. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and you make your, this is the kind of thing that is baked in the oven, right?
Yes.
So tell us how you make the dough.
So for the dough, so it's like a simple, relatively simple dough. So it's like water, flour, salt, and milk. And the proportion that
and
you
yeast.
Are...
And
no,
yeast.
And yeast. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. And yeast. And proportions depend from recipe to recipe. It's changed a lot. So I'm normally looking it up on the internet to find which one I'm going to make. But you can find different variations. Some of them are without milk. So if you want to make without milk, you can do the water-based. And sometimes they're even like, instead of milk, they're using yogurt to in the dough. So they are mixing like with the yogurt.
So it looks roughly like a pizza dough, more or less, the same consistency. And then you shape it into the eye shape, right?
Then you shape into the eye shape and with like a little deep part in the middle where you put the cheese, and you are putting in the oven with the cheese, and once it's like
lots of cheese
but it should not overflow.
Yeah,
so once you put in the oven, it's almost like raising and almost half done, more than half done, almost done. You are taking it out and then you're cracking the egg on top and putting it back again for 2 minutes maximum.
Right, because you want the yolk,
it's
still runny, right?
Yes, yolk should be runny.
So the white cooks, but the yolk is runny.
Yes.
Okay.
It sounds like a really good thing to have with wine.
A really good thing with wine, yes, I would suppose so. So Georgia is a wheat culture, basically, with corn, apparently, in some, like, on the coastal regions.
So the corn is on the west part, is very popular, and it becomes so common that a lot of like part of Georgia, instead of the wheat, they're using cornbread as a normal like staple food.
So in Georgia, is there a wheat growing region, or just every place people have? I mean, what's the wheat like? Is it imported at this point, or is it nationally milled, or are there still local pockets of wheat growers with small millers?
So we have a lot of small millers that are like
exciting.
Processing the grains of the wheat in particular. But in terms of production right now, we cannot produce enough to maintain our demand, so we are importing a lot of wheat. So,
probably from the Ukraine or something, huh?
Ukraine, Russia, and other parts of the neighboring countries that we have can import. So wheat is not produced in a big amount, but the parts of the countries that produce wheat are mostly in the middle of the Georgia, so which is, I don't know how to explain, right. But like it has its own wheat production, but it's not big enough still.
Well, now let's talk about the flavors and the herbs that you use, because so there was a stew. Is it a lamb stew that takes a lot of tarragon? What's that one called?
Oh, yes. So that's the lamb stew that takes a lot of tarragon. So it's called chakapuli.
Chakapuli. Okay. So Gio kept talking about chakapuli. Oh, we got to make chakapuli. And But to get that amount of tarragon around here is almost impossible because
this is not just a sprinkle of.
No, right. It's like a major vegetable component of the Shakapuli. So it took us a few years to figure out. At first I thought, Gio is a good gardener, so we're going to grow our own tarragon because you need bunches of it. You know, like if you go to the Hy-Vee to buy tarragon, you get like three sprigs for, you know, $2 or something. Ridiculous for a recipe like this. So we tried to figure out the tarragon, and at first I thought maybe it was something called Russian tarragon. So we hunted all over, and I went to Des Moines specifically and bought a lot of Russian tarragon plants, and we planted them. Nope, it wasn't Russian tarragon. Turns out that it is French, what we call in this country, French tarragon, is the kind of tarragon that they use in Georgian food. So now Gio has a lot of tarragon plants in the garden, so we can have Shakapuli at least in the summer.
Oh, yes. So that was a great contribution of yours to Georgian culinary part of AIM. So because I couldn't make any Shakapuli without tarragon. I mean, I could buy the tarragon on the local market, but it's very expensive. I mean, it's really too much to buy, like, to make one Shakapuli.
So how much do you need for a recipe?
So for a recipe, I use at least a pound, if not like more of the tarragon, because it's just like stews with this like green. So there's so much tarragon inside, like
it's really good. So it's, imagine a lamb stew with a lot of tarragon in. What else goes into the Shakapuli?
One thing that goes to Shakapuli is the wild plums, which we don't have here, but we have some other substitutions here. So, and we are using those substitutions, like you can use the rhubarb, or in my case, I am using the sorrel.
Sorrel instead. Sorrel. So in the book, the Georgian, what's it called, Tasting Georgia, she talks about, how do you pronounce this, the sour plum sauce?
Kemali.
Kemali,
yes.
Okay. Her recipe is using any plums that are not ripe. So next summer, when the damps and plums come, we'll go before they're ripe and we'll pick some and try this, because she uses fresh plums and coriander seeds, fennel seeds, garlic, chili, and herbs, mint, coriander, cilantro, and dill is what she uses in her plum sauce. So something to look forward to next summer. We'll try some local plums in that. Now, the other herbs that are really predominant, I kept seeing in the recipes, blue fenugreek.
Let's talk blue. I don't know fenugreek. Now that I know there's a
fenugreek is commonly used in Indian food, and it's also used as an herbal medicine. You can buy fenugreek seeds almost anywhere certainly at Wheatfield and stuff like that. But blue fenugreek is a different variety. So where do you get it? What do you do?
So the blue fenugreek, so normally it should be ground. So we mostly use the ground blue fenugreek.
But you buy it whole and grind it yourself.
So I buy it whole and I grind it here. And to be honest, my experience is that the blue fenugreek that I bought here, it doesn't taste exactly the same, the one that I have tasted in Georgia and the one that I can get from Georgia. I don't know exactly why. I suppose there's some slight difference in varieties. Or maybe like my grinding is not good enough. I don't know, something is missing there, but like still I'm using this local sources of blue fenugreek when I
need to make some in Georgia. At Pamel?
I buy in Pamel grocery and they're selling the whole seeds mostly. Mm-hmm. And
does it say just fenugreek or does it say blue fenugreek?
It says blue fenugreek.
Oh, okay. I'm going to run right out and buy some.
What do you use it in?
Well, okay, Gio, you made a bean dish with what? Fenugreek and cilantro, coriander seeds?
Coriander. Yes. So I made lobio. It's called lobio, which is simple, like a bean dish. There's not too much. So you're making you're boiling the beans with fenugreek and
almost like a
coriander.
Pinto bean, something really simple, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just cook it with the blue fenugreek and the coriander seeds, both ground, right?
Both ground.
Salt and pepper,
yes.
Probably.
Yes, salt and pepper, yes, and a little bit of onion, so like chopped onion.
Oh, it was really, really good.
And then when you are serving, you should have to put some cilantro, because we use a lot of cilantro in our cuisine.
Yeah, you do. You use cilantro and dill and tarragon.
Yes.
And you use lots of fresh herbs.
Yes. We have a lot of like greens, so I suppose it's natural that our cuisine are incorporating a lot of greens, because it's readily available. And
greens, And also another ingredient I saw in the book a lot, well, purslane is in the book. We can grow that here. And marigold leaves, marigold petals.
Yes. So that's the same marigold that we have here, actually. It looks the same. I don't think they are different. They actually smell the same. So what we are doing, so you'll go to the Georgia and you'll find like a lot of markets on the street. They are selling this flowers, the marigold flowers that are dried.
So the petals dried is what you cook with.
Yes, the dried petals. So you can buy the whole marigold like petals, or you can buy the grounded one. And you are using it in the cuisine. So very often they are using for the main purpose to give it a color, but marigold also has its own like taste. And in Georgian, we call it saffron. Actually, the name of the marigold.
But it's
saffron.
Not saffron. Yeah.
But it's not the saffron that you are seeing in Persian cuisine or some other cuisine.
Well, now there's one last thing you have to tell us about is making the trichella.
Well, let's save that for after this.
Oh, okay.
And because I'm hungry. I don't know. There's just all kinds of
right.
things.
Right, Gail, we're
going to
come over for lunch after the show. Okay.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Very good. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this fine show and all kinds of good programming on this community radio station by going to www.khoifm.org. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about food, of course. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, but we're talking about food from the country of Georgia with our friend Gio. I thought I'd do a little research myself here. And I have a little thing I want to share. A lot of these recipes that are, they're actually enjoying a rebirth in a popularity because these Georgian recipes are being adopted by people in the West, and restaurants are just going crazy over this stuff. It's a really good thing. This only happens because somebody bothered to write some of this stuff down. As Gio mentioned, there's a lot of variations in recipes and techniques and food traditions, because Georgia may not be a very big country, but it's got a lot of interesting people and interesting
and
places.
Old traditions.
Right. I ran across an author that is referred to a lot, probably as often as in Georgia, probably it's sort of like us referring to Julia Child. Okay, so also somebody wrote this down. Her name was Barbara Georgiadze. And she was born, believe it or not, in 1833. And she did a lot of interesting things. She was actually maybe, although she wouldn't probably say so herself, was first feminist. She decided she didn't have to follow the traditional way, and she tried her hand at a lot of interesting, different things. A lot of interesting things were happening in the middle of the 19th century, and she was one of them in Georgia. Barbara Georgiadze, she wrote a book called Georgian Cuisine and Tried Housekeeping Notes. And it's been reprinted a number of times. Believe it or not, it has 807 recipes in it. And it is kind of being rediscovered now. It never was really lost, but the idea that all this stuff is being rediscovered, it's a point of pride for the country. And here's a little something that I ran across. It is a time capsule from an era when recipes were passed down and hardly ever recorded. She wrote them down. And this compendium was especially valuable because under Soviet rule in Georgia from 1921 to 1991, many of the nation's cultural traditions, including gastronomic ones, were suppressed. Soviets were kind of, you know, making everything kind of standardized, and they tried to permit the cultivation of only four types of grapes and four types of cheeses, and that didn't
be
really
a little stifling.
Didn't really set so well with a lot of people, but their force was a big one, and so her book was a treasure trove of all of this stuff that can be rediscovered. And anyway, I was glad to see that.
Yeah, she left a map for current Georgians to follow after 70 years of Soviet rule.
Right, right. What we were going to talk about? Tricella.
Tricella. Gio and Paula, his wife, made tricella one winter. Tell us about the process, Gio. It's a dessert.
Yeah, now, see, I mentioned that there's not a lot of overtly sweet things, but this is an interesting sweet thing that happens in Georgia. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so tricella is very traditional. So it normally is made first time after you have your harvested your grapes, you made your juice, and that's when you are making tricella. So it happens after the harvest of the grapes. And the way you are making, you are taking the grape juice, you are mixing it with flour, and you are boiling it. So it kind of becomes gooey and paste. And then you are having a special like spring with the walnuts on it.
Right, you take a needle and you take a long thread and you string the walnuts so they're like a foot or more long, right?
Like popcorn and a
Christmas tree. Yeah, it's like stringing the walnuts. And then
you are like dipping them in this gooey mud.
In the grape syrup, yeah.
Grape syrup. And you are like dipping it and taking it out, and you might dip two or three times depending on the thickness that you want to have. And then you are hanging it to dry out for a week or two. Some people like to have it relatively fresh. And we are consuming it during the rest of the winter. So it's really full with nutrition. It's nutty. It has a sweet. It has this really nice, pleasant taste. And
it has a great texture, too, once it dries out.
It has
a candy kind of.
A grape nut log. Although I had the pleasure of watching this being done a couple years ago, and this ends up looking like a kitchen full of grape candles. Big,
yeah, they do. They look
candles.
Like lumpy candles when they're done.
Yeah. Grape candles or icicles or whatever you want to call it. And some people they think it's like look like a sausage. And
it is true.
I have a friend who was working in Russia several years ago, and he was like telling to his friend, that the tricellas are growing on the tree. So he makes them to believe that they're like actually growing on the tree in his like office, and people were really excited to come and see the tree that is having this beautiful tricellas growing on it.
Well, if it could happen any place, I suppose it could happen any place. It could happen in Georgia. Why not? Good. So if Donna and I, well, one of these days, if Donna and I were to visit Georgia, well, we like food and farming and things like that. What would you show us? What would you tell us we should go see?
Everything.
Everything. So the first thing what's very important for me to make sure that, like, you understand how diverse it is. So I will take you to different parts of Georgia to try the different cuisine and to see the difference in the nature and the surrounding and how much the people who are living there are benefiting from the surrounding rather than, like, trying to outsource stuff. So they are really depending on local resources. And I will take you to the mountains because I love mountains. So this is one of the beautiful parts of Georgia. So if you like mountains, you will enjoy it a lot. And the food and cuisine in mountains are really distinct from the one that you can down in the valley. And they have the special varieties of cheeses, and they have really popular dumplings there also, which is Georgian dumpling called Khinkali. And I will make sure that you will try all of these varieties.
And the wine. We have a wine tour also.
Wine is not even a questionable. So wine is every day you will have the wine. You will have the wine from the morning to the evening. So the wine is a separate part.
Yeah, very good.
I will say like one more thing. So once when we have some professors visiting to Georgia, I remember they took them to the university, one of the universities to meet professors. It was like 8:30 a.m. And when they arrived, they have the big Supra waiting for them with all the alcohol. So instead of like starting the day slowly, they're starting the day with a feast. And they were not expecting to start getting drunk early in the morning, but you know, like that was like one of the hospitality of Georgia. Sometimes it's getting too wild, but it's something that we want to like show our friends and our guests that we really love and appreciate, and we want to share with them food and wine and good time and singing and everything that can make them cheerful and happy.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
Well, and since Georgia, the whole country, is only half the size of Iowa, right? Is that what you said, Guillaume?
We could
cover the whole thing in a few weeks, maybe, huh?
Oh, I don't know. Sure. the idea of seaside and mountains and plains and apple trees and fruit trees and, oh, my goodness. Oh, one more thing. I tasted something at your house recently. And again, you said a friend brought or your brother brought this back from Georgia, which is always a good sign at your house. But this came from, so I had to taste this. It was some honey. And this, now I love all kinds of honey. This is a very dark, dark honey, but it was a special, it was the most floral, floral honey I'd ever tasted. What was that, Gail?
This is the chestnut honey that we had.
The chestnut honey. So you have chestnuts as well as hazelnuts and walnuts.
Of course.
We've got all of the, of course.
I mean, we have chestnuts. So the chestnuts are very popular too. It's like, and we can have like the fresh chestnuts made on the fire or in the oven. And one of the things that we also have is a chestnut honey. So it's harvested in particular period of the year. And normally these beehives are in the mountains. So it's like where the chestnut trees are around. And you can get this really dark, gooey, full of flavor, slightly earthy kind of honey, which is very distinct for any other honey that you can get. So that's the only honey that I will bring to here, because you can get so many different types of honey in the U.S., but this is the one that I cannot get anywhere, even though we have so many chestnut trees here and here.
I have had Italian chestnut honey, and it's in the similar vein, but the Georgian chestnut honey is the deepest, strongest honey I have ever had. And its taste even outweighs like the Iowa buckwheat honey, which I'm also very fond of.
Yeah.
But
see, so I have learned that this country
produces unique flavors.
And what real fun things to explore. How nice. And they're right kind of in the middle, like you mentioned, the trade routes of ancient trade routes, but they're also Georgia is also quite in the middle of a lot of political action right now, and we wish everybody the best. The Russian influence is on the border, not necessarily in Georgia anymore, or is the Russian influence still there?
They're still moving the borders, right?
So Russia is still there. So they have occupied 20% of Georgia right now. Even though we are small, they're still getting of Georgia. So it's like what happened in Ukraine. The same thing has happened in Georgia in 2008. And still
I think they're after the wine deal.
I don't know what they're after, but we are not enjoying it right now. And we hope that everything will get better, but it's been a part of the history of Georgia. So we've been invaded by any big empires around, like Ottoman, Persian, Arabs, Mongolians, Romans, Greeks, all of them came through Georgia at some point.
So and you're still Georgian in spite of it. So there.
In spite of this, we still keep our tradition, we keep our language, or keep whatever makes us Georgian. But at the same time, I can tell that a lot of things are coming from different culture and influences. And I suppose our cuisine is very different from all the others because we've been fusioning over centuries and millenniums, all the influences. And so we have a little bit of everything also.
Well, Georgia is on my bucket list, Gio. I'm hoping for a guided tour sometime in the not too distant future.
I'm hoping too.
Good. We got to get past COVID here so we can travel again.
Oh, good, good. Well, thank you for being with us. We've learned a lot from Gio, and it's so nice to have a good cook as one of your friends. So thank you for sharing what you know about Georgia. You've been so generous with your time and food and tastes and food knowledge. Thank you for joining us today, Gio.
And the book, by the way, is called Tasting Georgia, A Food and Wine Journey in the Caucasus. And they have it at the Ames Public Library. Very good. Thank you, Gio.
Thank you very much. And next time we'll have a show from Georgia, I hope so.
Oh, what a good idea.
Very good. Well, lovely. And I want to mention that,
next week we're going to do one more armchair travel. Gio's wife, Paula, is from Barcelona. So next week we're going to do Catalonian food.
Are we lucky or what? So there's another
bunch
of food.
You know, we eat around town. Without leaving Ames, we do all of this.
So we're going to do that with more armchair travel. You can find us here every Tuesday at noon. We do this show live without a net. Can you tell? Oh, yes. Also, this show is repeated 7 p.m. in the evening, or go to khoifm.org, and you can download, listen live, listen to past shows. We have our own Donna Lana Kitchen website there. Lots of handy things. And we can remind you that this is a community radio, which means that we get by with your goodwill and your donations. We are not owned by a big company. We are owned by this community, which means we have a say about what we can say. We have a good collection of people that are talking about their passions on this radio station. So do check out the website and find out all kinds of good things. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We had music today. Gio provided this music today from some Georgian polyphonic chanting music from the 10th century, and that was a song they were singing about winemaking, very appropriate. We also had music by David Cantini and John Berquist. Support this fine radio station. If we're in your ears, put us in your heart. My name is Lana Knoxville.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.